Hello, you're listening to Sarah Jackman, presenting this week's episode of Bricks and Mortar. My guest today is Catherine Fenn, professional support lawyer at city law firm Field Fisher, specialising in property. Good afternoon, Catherine.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks for having me back.
Catherine, it's a pleasure to have you back on Bricks and Mortar today. We are continuing our look at the basics of property law with a focus today on title deeds, the land registry, preliminary inquiries and taxation relating to property. Now, all transactions need to be recorded with land registry. For those who aren't familiar with the land registry, what is it? Can you describe the institution?
The land registry is a government organisation. I think it's described as an executive agency, so it's an arm of the government, and its job is to keep a register of all the land, hence the name, in England and Wales. The land registry was set up at the end of the 19th century, and there is still some land in England and Wales that isn't registered, but most property now is, but the land registry is aiming to get all titles registered.
Just in terms of what's registrable then, do you want to say a little bit about the difference between freeholds and leaseholds and how they work in terms of registration?
Well, the simple one is freehold land. On the register it will say it's freehold land, and there'll be the three parts of the register that we mentioned earlier. And then every time that land changes hands or anything happens with that land, then whatever has happened gets registered or noted on the title. So it shows a snapshot of what's going on that piece of property. However, leases also need registration, or some do. As from 13th of October 2003, leases of over 7 years need registering, and also reversionary leases, that's a lease of whatever length that takes effect more than 3 months in the future, they have to be registered as well. So you could have a 10-year office lease, say, and that will be registered in its own right. So when you look at the registered title on the landlord's title, you will then see in the charges register of the landlord's title, that's the freehold title, that there is a lease of the third floor or whatever it is. And then that registered lease can be transferred in the same way as freehold land, subject to any restrictions in the lease on assignment. A leasehold title will look pretty similar to the freehold one, still the three sections of the register, property, proprietorship and charges, but of course it will say it's leasehold land, and it will give you details at the top of the register of what the lease is, and that is an additional document that you will need to get hold of to obviously find out what that provides and to be able to report to your client on what it says. Before 2003, it was only much longer leases that were registrable. Originally, there was, I think, a 40-year limit, but latterly, so up to 2003, it was leases of over 21 years that needed registering. So in 2003, there was a big change in the law in that the lease registration limit came down from 21 to 7 years, so far more leases are now on the registered title. We carry out various searches at the land registry to enable us to work out what's going on. One of the searches we do is called Map Search. It's a bit like Google Maps, and it shows you a patchwork. You can turn on the layers, so it tells you all the titles that affect a certain area. So you get effectively a Google map up of the area, or it's the land registry map. And then it shows you the patchwork of all the different titles and the gaps in between, because sometimes there are gaps. Maybe there shouldn't be, but there often are. And where you have, for example, a block of flats, you will have a whole stack of title numbers that affect that particular property. You'll have the freehold title number, which is the landlord's title. Then you'll have, say, 20 different titles, separate titles for each of the flats. So the map search is a really, really useful way to work out what title numbers affect our property and also the surrounding properties, because sometimes, as part of the due diligence, we need to get copies of adjoining titles to try and work out what's going on. And now the register is open to the public, as it has been for some time now. Anyone can get a copy of anyone's register. Another search we would do is a SIM search of the index map. That's a slightly more formal version of the map search. So we give the land registry a plan and ask them to tell us what titles affect that land. There may, for example, be underground titles relating to mines and minerals. And then the final land registry search we do before exchange contracts is getting official copies of the title. As the name implies, it is an official copy of the register. There's a date and time stamp on it. And then just before completing a transaction, we do a priority search, which is a search looking back to the timestamp on the official copies and asking the Land Registry whether there have been any changes to the register since then, and we hope the answer is no, and our search comes back clear. And then when we have a clear priority search, that reserves our place in the queue so that we have 30 working days, 6 weeks, to send the application into the Land Registry, and we know that no one else can jump in ahead of us.
And what does a typical Land Registry title look like?
All registered land has an individual title number. So it gives you the number of the property and it gives you a prefix that gives you an indication of the county it's in. So, for example, properties that are in London have GL usually in their title number. K would be Kent, SYK would be South Yorkshire and so on. Then there's a number. So that's the identifier of your piece of land. And then when you actually look at the wording of the register, there are three sections. First of all, we have the property register, which describes what the property is. So it starts off with the address, obviously. It refers to a plan, the title plan, and then it will go on to set out what other things go with that property. For example, if it has the benefit of a right of way, that would be recorded in the property register. You then have the proprietorship register, which tells you who owns it. So in the proprietorship register, you would have the names, Mr. and Mrs. Smith or the company that owns that property. And also in the proprietorship register, there would be potentially some restrictions setting out limitations on how those people can deal with the property. And then thirdly, there's the C register, the charges register, which sets out things that affect the property. For example, a mortgage or other things like restrictive covenants or other things that adversely affect the land. So you can get a fairly good snapshot of what affects that piece of land by reading the Land Registry, but there are other things that we need to look for. There are some things that do not appear on the register, and that's what we're looking out for.
Okay. And do you want to talk me through what it is we're talking about when we're referring to title deeds?
Where we have unregistered land, then there's no Land Registry entry, obviously, and so the person's title to that land is proved by effectively a pile of documents going back in time, sometimes hundreds of years. It can be fascinating looking at these old deeds. So that's how you prove your title to the land. You have to produce a document, a conveyance or whatever, that's at least 15 years old, that proves you own the land. But even if you have registered land, there may be extra title deeds that affect the title and that you need to read to understand what's going on at that particular site. So, for example, you may have a charges register entry that talks about some restrictive covenants imposed in an old conveyance. And those may not be copied out on the register. You may need to get hold of that old conveyance to see what it looks like and what it says. There may also be leases that affect a Land Registry title. The charges register may list some leases that are noted against the title, but there may be some shorter ones that don't appear on the Land Registry title, and therefore also we need to see those. So the title deeds, the deeds packet will contain documents like that that we also need to go through.
Can we have a think now perhaps about the things that you're looking for on a title deed? There are various things that might crop up, and one of those is an easement. Can you describe what that is?
An easement is a historical word. I think it comes from the French "aise," actually, as in easy, ease. And it is a right that benefits land. And obviously there's a piece of land it burdens as well. So one of the simple forms of easement you can get is a right of way. So where your property doesn't adjoin the public highway, you need to make sure that you have a right of way from your property to the public highway. And ideally, you will have an express easement, an express right of way that includes that right. And there will be dominant land, that's the land that benefits from it. And there will be servient land, that's the land that is subject to it. And they have to be in different ownership. So one of the things we're checking when we're looking at title to a property is whether it has all the rights that are needed for the enjoyment of the property. Other things that you might have in an easement, quite a recent one that has been invented, so to speak, by case law, is an easement to park. Or you might have an easement to run pipes and wires. So you need services to reaching your property, so you may have an easement to run pipes underneath the adjoining property. All sorts of rights. So that's how easements work. That's what they are.
Covenants are something else that might crop up. Can you describe what they are?
There are two kinds of covenant. There's positive ones and restrictive covenants. Restrictive covenants are really, really important to check. It's something restricting the use of a property. So in the 19th century, for example, you often used to get covenants affecting land that are perhaps prohibiting unpleasant uses. It used to be things like tallow and catgut spinners and all sorts of old things. Mm. These days you might get a covenant on a building plot that says that only one house can be put up there, a private dwelling, okay. Or restricting the overall number of houses that can be built on a plot, or restricting business use, or restricting the sale of alcohol. So if there are restrictive covenants on the land, we need to report to our clients about what they say, and we also need to check that those covenants are still enforceable. We need to check who has the benefit of them. We need to check that they've been registered properly, if they needed to be, because if they did need registering and they haven't been, then they don't bind future owners. So restrictive covenants are really quite a tricky area, and that's one of the things we need to advise our clients on. There's no point in buying a site for use as a supermarket if, say, there's a ban on selling alcohol. Sometimes we can insure them away. You know, we can get some insurance against an outside chance that they might be enforced, but it obviously the client needs to make an informed decision about what covenants they are and whether they can live with them.
So just thinking then about the seller, what preliminary inquiries are you making of the seller?
The principle in English and Welsh conveyancing is buyer beware. It's up to the buyer to carry out due diligence to find out what's going on at the site. Now, the seller's not allowed to lie, of course, but the buyer is required to make such searches and inquiries as they deem fit to understand what's going on at the site. There are, in commercial property, a standard set of preliminary inquiries called the CPSEs, Commercial Property Standard Inquiries, and it's basically a questionnaire starting with fairly simple things like who owns the fences, you know, have there been any disputes with the neighbours, have there been any notices served. So you're just trying to flush out information about the property. Very often sellers are quite unhelpful when they're replying to CPSEs, and they'll say, please rely on your own inspection. But we're just trying to extract some information about the property, see if there's anything we need to know about, like problems regarding the use of the property or something like that. And the CPSEs stack up, really. There's CPSE 1, that's the general inquiries. Then there's other further inquiries that we use depending on whether it's a lease that's being granted or residential properties, that sort of thing. So basically you do CPSE 1 and then you decide what additional inquiries you need to raise. And sometimes we need to raise specialist inquiries that aren't CPSEs, for example, licensed premises. If you're buying a pub or a hotel, there's some really detailed information you need about the licensing there. We have extra inquiries we would raise about things like licensed premises or agricultural property, something like that.
Just thinking then about searches, can you tell me a little bit more about the other types of searches that you would undertake during a transaction?
Yes, I've already mentioned the CPSEs, which is basically a questionnaire we get the seller to answer. But there are all sorts of searches and inquiries that we can do as part of the due diligence process. And due diligence basically means doing all sorts of searches and inquiries to find out what's going on that piece of land. We're looking for anything that might interfere with what our client might want to do on the land. For example, a right of way running straight across the middle of something our client wants to build on, or restrictive covenants that stop our client doing what they want to do. Or we're looking for local authority issues, contaminated land. We're checking that the buildings and their use have got planning permission, and that if there are any conditions attached to the planning permission, that those have been complied with. So the sort of searches we order in any event will be a local search. There's actually two halves to that search, the local land charges search, LLC 1, which will show us things like planning permissions, listed buildings, conservation areas, because obviously if it's a listed building and our client wants to tear it down, there's a problem. That's something we need to report to our client on. You've then got the local search, CON 29, which tells us more information about the property from the local authority's perspective, whether there are any road schemes nearby, whether any notices have been served in respect to the property. We would also do, in every case, a drainage and water search, which is to check that the property is connected to the mains drainage and the mains water. We would also probably, in every case, do a highway search, certainly for development land, to make sure that our property abuts the highway and that we don't need a right of way to get to the public highway from our property. Also, in most cases, we would do environmental and flood searches, so to check that the property isn't built on contaminated land, for example, an old chemical plant or something like that, or that if it was, that it's been remediated properly. And flood searches, again, we would check that the property isn't in a flood zone. It's not just riverside and properties that are affected. The flood water can come through the ground. And flood is very important because if your property is in a flood zone, it may be very difficult or impossible to insure. There are other searches we might do depending on the area. So common searches, that's an additional inquiry on the local search. If there's open land nearby or on part of our property, we would do a common search because if it is a registered common, then it restricts what can be done on the land and it certainly can't be built on. Chancel repair, we might do a chancel repair search. Some people do those in every case. And we might want to find out about the planning history of the site or the planning situation nearby, what's going on in the vicinity, what new developments are planned, or in a residential context, whether neighbours have managed to get planning permission for loft conversions or whatever. And there's also all sorts of other searches that we can order depending on the situation of the property. For example, if it's by a railway line or a river or a canal, there are special searches we can do. If it's in a mining area, then we would do a coal search to make sure that the property isn't about to fall down a coal mine. We might do an HS2 search if the property is near the HS2 route. We can do utility searches, gas, electric, BT, cable. Where do those run? Are they going to get in the way of our new development? There's all sorts of specialist searches you can do, and they can be very expensive. It's important to work out which searches are sensible to do rather than just ordering the whole lot. But it can cost hundreds, if not thousands of pounds to do all the searches that you need on a commercial site.
You touched on insurance a moment ago, and something that might be raised during the conveyance is title indemnity insurance. Can you describe a little bit about what that is and when it would be applicable?
Title indemnity insurance is a strange kind of insurance because it's a one-off premium and the policy usually runs for an indefinite period and it benefits future owners of the property. So, for example, we mentioned earlier there might be a restrictive covenant against business use or something, and that might be what we want to use the property for. So basically, if there is a problem with the title, there might be a missing right of way, or there might be an awkward restrictive covenant, we could consider getting title indemnity insurance. So you approach the insurer, show them the title deeds, explain the situation, talk to them about what your client's proposing to do to the property. It may be that, you know, the covenant's really, really old and you have no idea who has the benefit of it. So the insurer may say, OK, the risk's not very great. Or with a right of way, you may not have an express right of way, but somebody may have been using that right of way for decades. So the insurer will be fairly relaxed and say, OK, we'll cover you because there's probably a prescriptive right of way there. And what the insurance does, it doesn't make the problem go away, but if, say, someone pops up and tries to enforce your restrictive covenant, the insurer will fight the case for you and either buy them off or fight it in the courts. So basically, you have a fighting fund.
We've talked then a little bit about what the seller's looking for in the process and how they can be protected. Can you talk a little bit about what the lender's looking for in the process?
Yeah, where a lender is involved, whether it's a residential or commercial property, their overall concern is that the property is worth what they are lending or more than what they're lending, so that if all else fails and they have to repossess the property, they can sell it to realise the debt that's owing to them and get paid back. So the lender is looking at it from a slightly different angle than the buyer. Similar considerations, but the lender will often be a bit more cautious. So it may be the lender, for example, that insists on getting title indemnity insurance. The buyer may just be prepared to take the risk, but the lender will say, no, I want insurance in place. So the lender is just looking to make sure that everything stacks up, that the property's got planning permission, its use has got planning permission, you know, that the title deeds stack up, that there's nothing that's going to prevent their mortgage being registered against the property.
And finally, just to draw it together, one thing we need to touch on is it's just the tax position in relation to the sale of property. Can you tell us what we're talking about here?
Well, we could be here all night if we were discussing the ins and outs of the taxation of real estate. And there's all sorts of taxes and tax planning that needs to be borne in mind, and specialist advice is needed. But on conveyancing, the one tax that hits us firmly between the eyes, well, depending on whether you're in England or Wales, is SDLT, stamp duty land tax for properties in England, and land transaction tax, LTT, for properties in Wales. So that is a tax on transactions. And I'm sure many people have encountered the dreaded stamp duty, as it's nicknamed, you know, when you buy a new house or a new flat. And SDLT, or land transaction tax, can be quite a lot of money. And that is a tax that has to be paid very soon after completion. In England, it has to be paid within 14 days of the effective date, which is normally completion. And in Wales, within 30 days. So that's one of the amounts we have to collect from our client on completion to make sure that we've got the SDLT, or the land transaction tax, money to pay away as soon as we've completed, because there's fines and interest penalties if we're late.
Catherine, I think that concludes our series looking at the conveyancing process. Thank you very much for demystifying the various steps for us. For more information on developing a career in real estate, see egi.co.uk and the archive of the Bricks and Mortar series at podbean.com.